So we're going to continue this theme of exploring differentiation. And of course, I know that, you know, like your prose relativity, you've seen quite a bit of it before. But one of the things that I rather like about at least the mathematics part of differential geometry is that it's not just a case of sort of introducing a whole lot of formalism just for the sake of it. I think, you know, here the mathematics is very much intrinsically tied to sort of intuitive understanding and pictures. And so in talking about the Lie derivative, I want to just introduce it by thinking about how we take a derivative. You know, when we first meet derivatives in calculus, how do we define them? What bits of that carry over, or can we make it make sense in the context of the manifold? And so when we take a derivative, what we're kind of doing is taking this infinitesimal process. We start in one point, we've got an object, Q. I'm not saying whether it's scalar, vector, or whatever, but we have this object Q, and then we move a little bit away from our original point, and that is our Q of t plus delta t. We compare it to the Q back where we originally were. So we take that difference and divide by delta t. And so in the case of real analysis, just functions on a simple plot, that just gives you the gradient, and that is, you know, that is a well-defined process. So obviously there's a lot more analysis lying underneath that, but still, that is the basic idea. So if we want to generalize that to the manifold, then we have a few things that we've got to deal with. So first of all, we've got to sort of think, what does delta t mean? So what is delta t? Because if we're thinking about taking a derivative, what we're really doing is we're looking at some two different points, p and p prime, where in some sense this they're very close. So we have to think about what does this, I should say that delta t. What does that delta t mean? So that's one challenge that we've got. And then another challenge that we have is to think about what q is. So if q is a function, then we're kind of okay because we know that functions are elements of C infinity of m. And so we've already actually thought about differentiation of functions because we talked about them being infinitely differentiable, and the way we did that was kind of take a local chart, go down into the R to the N and work with it there. So our other challenge, so that's challenge one, the challenge is Q. So for example, if Q is a vector, then Q at P is in a different space to Q at P prime, or a Q of T plus delta T, or Q plus delta Q. So those are the roadblocks, if you like, to defining that naive object. So we just have to sort of figure out, can we do that? How do we do it? You've already seen one way of doing it, which is the connection. And the connection kind of is a way of gluing tangent spaces together as you move around. But here we're going to try and do it without a metric and without a connection. So what we need to do, if we think about our object here and our object here, and this is the same as the connection concept at least, so we have to be able to relate tangent spaces at nearby points. So I hope you can see the prime there. Okay, so how we're going to do that is actually we're going to do it by taking a very specific connection, or what. Trouble is, if I use the word connection, it's going to sort of trigger other interpretations. Very relation. I'll think about that one. Okay. So the way that we are going to relate tangent spaces is the structure that we're going to do is we're going to take a sort of, if you like, a way of combing the manifold. So what we do is we take a set of curves. So if we have a vector field T, then we construct these curves, and they're known as integral curves. And they're basically just defined by saying that T is their tangent. So whilst we might have a vector field for which this can't be done globally, it's certainly something that we can do locally. So in essence, you could think of it almost as choosing coordinates. I sometimes just think of it as almost combing. I'm just choosing a sort of family of these one-dimensional curves. And so here, this might be my T, or the point P. This might be T plus delta T, or the point P prime. And now we have a meaningful way of saying what delta T might be, because we know that we've got a point in the manifold. We can identify a curve that it sits on, and therefore our T is just the value of the real number that corresponds to P, and our T plus delta T just takes us a little way further along the curve. So we've now, at least, you know, this isn't more intuitively, it's not yet mathematical. This is a way of thinking about how to define what we mean by T plus delta T. So here, our P sort of corresponds to some coordinates in a local chart. And then if we move a little bit along that curve to P prime, that means that the difference between P and P prime is just some small increment in the various coordinates. But I could think of this as a coordinate transformation. In other words, I could say that these are x prime coordinates. And so the delta x is just of leading order, is just a little piece of T. And so that's the sort of, that's the idea, that's the sort of structure of what we're going to do, just a bit more formally. And so in essence, if we've got a geometric object Q, we've got Q sitting here at P. We also have a Q sitting at P primed. But if we want to compare the Q at P prime with the Q at P, we kind of have to slide our tangent space along here, and we think of doing that via a coordinate transformation. So it's sort of a slightly different way of thinking about what it means to sort of shift a little bit. So let me just put a bit more formal structure about that, around that. So that first bit was really just trying to kind of explain or motivate what the purpose was and what we were doing and why we're sort of about to just say a little bit more slightly abstract stuff. So if we have a manifold M, let's say it's got dimension M, then we could potentially construct a map. We've got two manifolds, M and N, and their dimensions don't have to be the same. Then we can imagine that we have a map from M either into or onto N, where we just take, we have a point here, P, we have an image Q, and we just associate points in N with points in M. So as per usual, what we do is we look at the local chart for each of these. And then because we can map P down onto an image here using one of the local coordinate labels and Q down to some point here, again using a local chart, that means that we can sort of construct an F between the two locally flat RM from RM into RN. So this is a map from RM to RN. So this is just in general what we mean by a map, and then we ask, as again I said, I like my C infinities, so if we're dealing with our infinitely differentiable manifolds, we ask that this map here is infinitely differentiable. So, I mean, as an example, although we're going to obviously think about where M and N are the same, but one example of this type of map might be where M is the two-sphere. It's a two-dimensional manifold, and we might map it into N, into R cubed, where we say that, you know, we literally just draw the sphere. We say it's a set of points of a, you know, fixed distance from the origin. So that would be an example of a map between two manifolds that was, you know, where the dimensions were not different, but nonetheless, it's a very familiar sort of map. So here, what we're interested in So if f is 1 to 1 and on 2, so in other words, you know, if there's a single point over here in n corresponding to points. Do I mean that 1 to 1? Every point here has a unique pre-image over here, and on 2 means all of n is covered by the map. Okay, so that means it's invertible. And then we call it a diffeomorphism. And we basically say that the two manifolds are the same, which is what I wrote up there. So in terms of those integral curves that I drew, and thinking of that transformation as sliding along the integral curves, that's an example of a diffeomorphism. So we're just moving the manifold a little bit. So I guess an example there might be to take that two-sphere and then just imagine just rotating it a little bit, right? So that would be an example where we would be sliding the manifold along lines of constant latitude. So we would just be sort of shifting a little bit along those curves. So how does it link vector spaces? Tangent spaces? So again, we're interested in the diffeomorphism, but actually this is still true even if it's this more general picture with the two dimensions not exactly the same. You can take the tangent space in M and then map it onto the tangent space in N. So remember that vectors are just tangents to curves. So here is our curve in M with some tangent vector T. Then this gamma over here has an image in N. Let's say it's gamma primed. This is our Q. And then remember our curve was a map from the reals into the manifold. So we can construct the gamma prime by simply going via M. So we start between our interval on the reals, we make our curve in the manifold, and then we map it over into N using our function. Then the tangent vector here will have a corresponding tangent vector, let's call it S for the time being, over in N. And so we can identify T So in other words, we've got this map, F lower star. So we simply just do it. That's sort of how you set it up, you know, sort of strictly speaking. But you can see that you could map that tangent plane at P over to at least either the tangent plane at Q or some subspace of it. But it is definitely, it's a map from TP of M into TQ of N. So that's for vectors. And then for the covectors or the cotangent space, this gives you a map from the cotangent space of N back into M. And so just remember that the cotangent space was the set of linear maps from the vector space into the reals. So here the picture would be, you've got TP of M, you can push it forward to TQ of N. Omega is a map from the tangent space in N down to the reals, and so that allows you to construct a map from the tangent space of N down to the reals. So obviously, if you've got a diffeomorphism, if you have a diffeo, then you can sort of, you can relate, sort of push forward and pull back both the tangent spaces as well as the cotangent spaces. So now let's think about what that means if we go back to our original sort of challenge, which was in thinking about what could we define as a derivative now that we have a way of linking those tangent spaces. So here our picture is that we have these integral curves, gamma, of which have their tangent vectors t. And so we've got a point P, and then we have a second vector field S. So we want to differentiate S. That's our aim. And what we've said is that we've got a way now of moving forward from P to P plus delta P, or T to T plus delta T, if you like. So we've got our function here, so this is going to be our S at Q. And then we want to compare that. So our idea is that we want to compare it to S. We can't compare it to S directly because that's a different vector space. But what we can do is push forward that vector space to the new point, and then we can subtract because now the two will be in the same vector space. So, let me just start by push forward, sorry. So I'm going to use our sort of classic physicist notation here. So S at pushing forward to P plus delta P. So this is our, S of X prime mu, okay? So here we're looking at taking our S, but making a coordinate transformation. So our S of X prime is really S of X plus delta X, and our delta X was epsilon T. So I think about what happens to the components of the vector when I transform. And so what I have to do is I have to take the coordinate transformation dx prime with respect to dx. So this is not the value of the vector field S at Q, but this is saying it's the value of S here, but with the coordinate shifted. So I'm going to, that's me, sort of the equivalent of this sliding the point P into Q. On the other hand, if I ask what's the value of my vector field at this, what's the actual value of S at Q? Well, then it's going to be the value at S of P times the sort of rate at which the components are changing. So if we hadn't thought about maps and manifolds, this is really what we would have tried to do first as a derivative. We would have said, well, we just take the derivative of S along T. And that's kind of our derivative. But then we see that doesn't work under coordinate transformations. So here, if I now put this together and say, what's my value of S at Q minus, and then I want to take that pushed forward version. So this is minus S at P pushed forward divided by our delta P, if you like, our delta X. So in terms of components, that's S naught mu plus epsilon T nu, S mu comma nu. I've got to subtract this pushed forward version, which is, put it as mu, haven't I? S naught mu minus epsilon T nu comma mu. Sorry, mu. And then since epsilon here is representing my delta T, so to speak, this is what I get. And so what you see is obviously these terms cancel, and I end up with T nu, S mu comma nu, minus S T mu comma nu. So if you compare that to that very abstract geometric thing that I introduced at the end of Monday's lecture, this is in fact the Lie bracket of S and T. But the difference with this way of going about it is that you can then take a Lie derivative not just of a vector, but of any object. So I usually set as an exercise. So I think one of the things that's sort of confusing here is probably because I've kind of done a lot of this in the sort of very classical 19th century notation with indices, but at the same time been talking about maps. But really the key, if you like, here is that you're sort of basing your argument around P. You know what the value of S is a little bit away from P, because this is what you would do if you were just taking a sort of very naive approach. You would say, well, I know how S changes. I just take the way S changes along that integral curve, T. But what you've also got to take into account is the fact that, strictly speaking, those two are not the same point. Therefore, it's not the same tangent space. And so you have to ask, how would, if I want to compare S at Q, how would I move that forward? And so here, the change in S is coming from that change of coordinates. So there's sort of two different ways S can change. One is it changes because it's a vector field, and that's this piece. And then the second bit is it changes because you slid along the integral curve, and that's that piece. So it's not so obvious when you're doing it in sort of standard R cubed, where everything's flat, so everything is sort of behaving as it should. But once you're on a curve manifold, that starts to become more relevant. So there's a couple of things that the Lie derivative, you know, why do we care about it? And there's essentially because it often has quite a lot to do either about having some sort of geometrical significance or helping us with coordinates or thinking about our metrics when we have a metric. And so what the Lie bracket does, so this is going back to the Lie bracket. So when I introduced the bracket initially, I introduced it as a sort of simple commutator of vectors acting on functions. And what that really boils down to is saying, well, if I have two sets of integral curves, let's say I've got S and I've got T, I'm what happens if I go first along T and then along S and compare that to having gone along S and then along T. So is that the same thing? Does that process commute? So how do we see that? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, obviously this is meant to be a small local patch, so that I'm going to be in a given chart. So there's going to be, I'm going to calculate the coordinates of B and the coordinates of D given in terms of the coordinates at the origin, O. So first of all, let me just say what XA are. So XA, that's by going, let's say, a small distance, S, along an integral curve of the vector field S. So what we were doing before, we were just taking the leading order term, the linear term. What I'm going to have to do here is take this Taylor series to the next level. So as I expand and find out the coordinates of A, I can just sort of keep expanding in that small parameter S, but here I'm going to stop at order S squared. So that's my expansion, and therefore XB, well, that's going to be XA plus T times T, our vector field sitting at A, plus a half T squared, T at A nu, T at A mu comma nu. So I've just literally taken that same expression and gone from A to B. And now what I have to do is fill in what XA is, so that's X naught. So that's my X naught. Then I fill out what is my T at A. Well, that is T at naught. And then I have to take S naught, the derivative of T along S. And I only need keep that to first order because it's already at first order outside. And then because this is at second order, I can replace that with T naught. So just to batch these together, this lot here is XA. This here is the second term. And then the last term is just as it is. So that's B. And so if we go the other way round, the only thing that changes is I swap my S's and T's, both in terms of the S naught mu's, T naught mu's, as well as the small parameters S and T. And so what you see, if I do this swap, the X naught term is going to be the same. So let me just... I didn't want to make the same argument, so that becomes a T naught mu plus a half T squared T naught nu comma nu plus S S naught mu. So all I've done there is done exactly that swap that I was saying. And so now you can see that this gap here, this vector here, the bit by which that process doesn't commute, the x naughts cancel, that linear term goes with that one there, this one cancels that one there. The half t squared there is cancelled by that, this half s squared there is cancelled by that. And so all I'm left with is st and then t naught nu, s naught mu, comma nu. And so we just saw that that was indeed Ts, the Lie bracket. So the Lie bracket tells you by how much that process doesn't commute. It gives you that gap. And then the other useful thing that the Lie derivative does is tells us about symmetries. So when we have a metric, it's very useful to know whether it has any vectors with which the Lie derivative vanishes. So in other words, are there certain vector fields for which the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes? So again, going back to thinking about those, as it all right at the beginning, thinking about those integral curves, if the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes, what that means is if you're going around these integral curves, your metric still looks the same. And so that's a symmetry. And so again, I think the sort of a nice example there is our two-sphere, where we write it in terms of the sort of standard polar angles. So this is our metric, as we would standardly write it. Then if I take the vector d by d phi, the coordinate basis vector d by d phi, and then I write out what the Lie derivative is, the expression, because k is just d by d phi, in components, k is just 0, 1. So both of these partial derivatives vanish. And then this is just d by d phi of g mu nu, which equals zero. So what that tells you is that the metric doesn't really change if you drag or if you sort of rotate your sphere, and that metric looks identical. And so that's an example of of a Killing vector. More generally, it's this is not the only Killing vector, because the sphere is actually invariant under SO3 and not U1. So if you want to have a bit of fun, you can find the other Killing vectors. But knowing something about the Killing vectors and the Killing symmetries of your metric often means that you can reduce the number of functions in your metric. So for example, if you know there's an SO3 symmetry, that tells you you have three Killing vectors that satisfy an SO3 algebra. What you can then do is you look at the consequences of this Killing equation here, and you see that by working it through, that you can choose coordinates such that you have part of your metric is this subspace, this sort of unit sphere metric, but it also tells you a lot about cross terms. So it tells you don't have cross terms either in your metric. And so since, the Einstein equations are nonlinear and coupled, that having symmetries is pretty essential to reducing degrees of freedom. So I just want to spend the last 10 minutes talking a little bit about the exterior derivative. So if you look at the structure of the Lie bracket, so if I go back over here to what it looks like in the sort of physicist notation, you kind of see this anti-symmetry. Here it's really obvious because it's a commutator, TS minus ST. And so here you see this sort of swapping of with the differentiation. This is the derivative of S along T, partial derivative, minus the partial derivative T along S in components. And so there you've kind of got this anti-symmetry. So remember I pointed out that if you try to just take the partial derivative, when you look at what happens under a coordinate transformation, you end up with a piece that is non-geometric. The second partial derivative of the coordinate transformation. And so the challenge is always to kill that piece. Here we've killed it by having this commutator. But there's another way of killing it, and that's just absolutely by knocking it on the head, by making your differentiation purely anti-symmetric. So what does that mean? If we're trying to take a derivative that's purely anti-symmetric, then we have to be careful what we act on it with, because if we have like a metric tensor, which is symmetric typically, does it make sense to take some sort of anti-symmetric derivative? Kind of what's going on there. So in the end, what we have to do is to sort of introduce a whole sort of set of particular structures on the manifold which are purely anti-symmetric covariant objects. So they live in tensor products of the covector space or the covector bundle of the manifold. So let me just start by, we build it up. So acting on a function, this is where we've already done it. So D, acting on a function, takes you from C infinity of M into T star of M, so the dual bundle on M. And we define it, our DF, by saying that DF, we use our map, the fact that our covector is a map from vectors to the reals, so DF acting on a vector is equal to T acting on F. Remember, the definition of the vector was the map on C infinity functions on M. And that has to be true for all T in, let's say, T of M, T and P and M. So that is how we define DF. And we can think of it if we've got a function locally of f equals constant defines a hypersurface. So if we ask what are the surfaces with our f equals constant, then we can sort of imagine those constructing some sort of foliation of our manifold. I'll call these surfaces, let's say they're sigmas. So you have to be a little careful about this, but we can think of DF as normal. So I have to be a little careful because normals are really vectors, but it's a pictorial way of looking at it. So I think if you look at Misnethorn and Wheeler, they talk about this. They have a lot of these types of pictures. So it is a geometric operator, but at the moment this is just acting on scalars. So we want to be able to generalize it to actual, higher rank objects. So we then have to say, what do we mean? So we need to define a P form. So just as when you see the tensor product and it's made up of you take objects. So that if A here is a simple covector, you might just take objects that look like A tensor B, and that sort of spans the space of rank 2 covariant tensors. Well, here we take an anti-symmetric product as saying it's A tensor B minus B tensor A. So this is both defining the wedge product . So this is how these forms are built up. They're just anti-symmetric tensor products. So that wedge, you can see that it's a linear multiplication, but it's obviously not commutative. So I just want to show you in components. How we generalize this. So if A is a P form and B is a Q form, and then I want to find out what the components of that P plus Q form R, we have to take a completely anti-symmetric combination. So we get this combinatorial factor. So that is our defining our wedge product. So it's certainly not commutative, but it's not necessarily anti-commutative. It depends on the rank. So we say P is the rank of the form. So just as we talk about a tangent bundle, we can talk about the bundle, if you like, of p-forms on the manifold. So note that p is less than or equal to n, the dimension of the manifold. Because if you try and anti-symmetrize more co-vectors than there are dimensions in the manifold by linear dependence, I mean, that what's the dimension of the manifold? It's the maximum number of linearly independent vectors or co-vectors that you can have. If you try and put more in, anti-symmetrize, then you're going to get zero. So the n form is unique up to a factor. And it's really proportional to this epsilon tensor, which is just gives you the sign of the permutation of A, B, C, D. Strictly speaking, our n form is a tensor density, but gosh, so intimidate with everyone coming. Does the next one start at 10:15 or at 10? 10:15. Okay. So what you then have, because you've now constructed these objects which are purely anti-symmetric, what the exterior derivative does is it takes from our messy physicist notation, it takes a completely anti-symmetric derivative. So more or less what you're going to see is you take the partial derivative of a P form and then you just put the little square brackets, which mean anti-symmetrization, and that will give you, if you then look at the properties under the coordinate transformations, that will tell you that this is indeed something geometric. From the mathematician's perspective, D is a map from lambda P into lambda P plus 1 such that it is pseudo-Leibnizian, and that it reduces to this D acting on functions. So again, it's just that parallel way of defining something from a more abstract perspective, but then if you have to work with it, how do you see what it means in terms of what it does to the object that you're looking at? Okay, so we'll pick this up on Friday and kind of wrap up our differentiation and structure. Thanks.